Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
In 1990, the makers of Basket Case and Brain Damage bring you... Frankenhooker.
Jeffrey Franken has a plan.
I just want to bring him back a little bit.
He has the ingenuity.
I need female body parts.
He has everything he needs, except the raw materials.
Just hold still. Fix. Oh my God. Bunyan!
Wow! Jeffrey's creation is alive.
Look for some action?
Oh yeah!
She's
sexy.
On a date, you going out?
I'm on my way home, but thanks anyway.
And she's so jerked to please.
Listen, I'm looking for a very tall, attractive woman. She's purple. She's got fresh bars on her.
She's in the bar!
Now, a motion picture like no other. A tender story of love and romance.
On a date!
A gripping tale of lust and revenge. Frankenhooker.
Incredible.
Some assembly may be required.
Welcome to another episode of the Projection Booth. I'm Mike White, and I'm joined by frequent co-host Rob St. Mary.
Thank you, sir. But I have to admit, I'm a little distracted by all the super crack you left laying around the Projection Booth this week. I mean, in between the splicers and the reels and whatnot.
Just call it temptation. Try to avoid it. So, you know, for gosh sakes, Rob, you've been on the show a lot lately. I think we've been doing some good work, you know, with the Manos episode, Punishment Park Series 7, and the Battle Royale trifecta. And now you're pulling my fat out of the fire by coming on this Frankenhooker episode at the last minute when my original co-host, who shall remain nameless, had to drop out at the last minute. So why don't we just make it official? I'm going to get down here on one knee. Rob, will you Saint Mary me?
Oh, I would be honored. Where do you want to register?
How about one of our sponsors, maybe like Adam and Eve? Act now with the promotion code of Booth, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth, and take 50% off nearly any item and get free shipping. That's at adamandeve.com. Act now.
Sounds good, but you know what the problem is, Mike? I just remember that same-sex marriage is illegal in this state,
Yeah.
I guess I can't be your co-host in life, but I'll be happy to be your co-host here on the Projection Booth.
All right, then. It's official. Welcome aboard the new co-host of the Projection Booth, Rob St. Mary, you poor bastard. Now, let's go ahead and get down to brass tacks and talk about this week's film, Frankenhooker. This 1990 film from Frank Henenlotter was actually shot before he did Basket Case 2, but came out a month after BC 2. I don't remember Frankenhooker playing in theaters, at least the theater where I was working at the time, but I sure do remember the video box from my days at Blockbuster. I came to Frankenhooker pretty late in the game, but even after 22 years, it's really got a vivacity about it that still speaks to me. It's the story of Jeffrey Franken, get it, Franken, a helpless medical examiner whose fiancée, Elizabeth Shelley, dies in a tragic lawnmower accident. Jeffrey vows to bring Elizabeth back and make her better than ever with the help of a troop of Manhattan prostitutes and some super crack. Alas, not everything goes to plan. I finally saw this film after all these years. It still stands up. I love the colors about this thing. I love the performances. I thought that it was very much on that great line between, I won't even say it was a horror comedy because it's definitely much more comic than horror, but it's got the nice horror elements that it plays around with. What were your initial thoughts when you saw this thing, Rob?
Well, I didn't get a chance to see it really until... I guess for
Tuesday.
Yeah. Well, I think I saw it before. You know, I worked at Thomas Video, so we had everything, and I probably have seen most of the stuff they have. To me, what Frankenhooker seems like a mix between like Tales from the Crypt, Cracked Magazine, which is sort of the low rent version of Mad, and, you know, Mary Shelley, just the original Frankenstein, because there are a lot of elements, obviously, with the original film beyond the obvious, you know, parody riff almost on the Frankenstein story.
The first time I watched this was actually on a plane. And of course, all the boobs and butts and everything were kind of embarrassing. Well, it was like whenever the guy who was next to me wasn't looking at my screen. That was like, you know, the normal parts of the movie. But the first time that I saw it, I was really kind of was amused. I found it very enjoyable. But the act structure felt really weird to me. Like, I thought for sure that, you know, obviously a film named Frankenhooker, you're going to get a Frankenhooker in here at some point. And I thought for sure I was going to get her a lot earlier than I did. And it felt like a really kind of ended right about where it should be starting. But then watching it subsequent times, I was like, okay, makes total sense to me now. Really feels natural. But I don't know what it was about that first time I saw it. I was just like really hoping for more.
We really only get her for less than a third of the film. I can understand that feeling, especially when the title was what it was.
So I'm glad you made a reference to Cracked Magazine, because I always felt like I was the only one that ever read Cracked Magazine. And I don't know what it was. Maybe it was because I was a kid. I just wasn't ready for Mad, and Cracked seemed funnier to me. Maybe it was because I enjoy lower brow humor. So it definitely felt like that. And it does feel like, yeah, Tales from the Crypt, or even like, what the hell was that Steven Spielberg show?
Yeah, it was Amazing Stories.
I don't want to say Amazing Stories, because obviously they wouldn't allow the level of nudity on there, but it reminded me of that kind of wacky humor that was in like the Hell to Pay episode, you know. But yeah, definitely like a Tales from the Crypt or some of these like Masters of Horror kind of episodes where it's like, you know, more experimental.
I don't know what it was. I mean, when I used to read Cracked Magazine, like the humor really wasn't at the same level as Mad. It was kind of like the second string, and it's nothing against Frank Henenlotter. I mean, it's really good, but some of the humor is so telegraphed that you already know the joke before it's coming out of his mouth. But I think it's really like that. That's why I had to put it in the Cracked Magazine arena.
Yeah, definitely. You can see some of the jokes coming like a mile away, but you don't really necessarily know what Jeffrey Franken is going to do. I mean, James Lawrence plays him just on the edge. He plays him very straight, but every once in a while he does or says things where you're just like, where the hell did that happen? You know, where did that come from? Like, there's one part where he's like waiting for something to happen and he does this like little dance and it's like, what? What was that? And it was great. I mean, his performance is amazing. I love his like thick accent that he has in it. And it's just, it works perfectly for the role. And I love the kind of just straight ahead nonchalance that the movie has. It starts off with Jeffrey at this table with a brain, and he's just there like playing with this brain and trying to get it to react and all this kind of stuff. And then you realize that he's doing it like on the dining room table and no one is really paying him any mind.
The tone is, to me, it's sort of this idealistic 50s suburbia, and it's like mom's in the kitchen making food and there's like the barbecue in the backyard and everything's really idyllic. It's just like, oh well, this happens all the time. It's like nobody's freaked out. Mom's like, I don't know, whipping up a batch of, you know, egg salad or potato salad or something for the barbecue in the back. And then the only comments that you have to him, the mother comes into the backyard and says to Elizabeth, his girlfriend, you know, you need to stop eating those pretzels. They'll make you fat. And then it's like, and Jeffrey needs to be not so strange today. And it's just like the two things, you know, right there in terms of like what you should be gender role wise. If you're a man, don't be too weird or strange. And if you're a girl, don't be too fat.
I fell in love with Patty Mullen as Elizabeth Shelley, both in the fat suit and definitely out of the fat suit when she does play the titular Frankenhooker. Oh my God, she is smoking hot in this film. And I love every second she's on frame. And she's got such great timing and just the chops, the comedy chops. And this was only her second film, second and, as far as I know, final film.
All of the little quirks and tics that she has in terms of like, you get the feeling that she has been kind of put together out of all these sort of disparate parts, and the parts really don't want to communicate and work well together. That I think is really interesting.
Yeah, we should also talk about interesting performances. Louise Lasser showing up as Jeffrey's mother, you had mentioned, and it was this kind of interesting performance because it was all overdubbed later on. Apparently when she came to set, she had, you know, blown out her voice. And so it was a good performance, but it felt like a very strange one because her mouth doesn't necessarily line up with her her words all the time. It's like, why is this happening? It was like, and then she's there at the beginning and really doesn't come back ever again, which was kind of sad. I was hoping like she would come back at some point. And but yeah, that opening and the you know, the horrific lawnmower accident that I mentioned before really puts things into the right space for this kind of offbeat, I think is going to be the nicest word for it, this offbeat film.
You know, you were talking about the lawnmower accident, and obviously as someone who works in media, I'm very critical of media and how other people do it, because I always joke that people trust the media about as much as they trust used car salesmen and pedophiles. So I'm always trying to find ways to, you know, improve the scope of how much people appreciate what we do as reporters and things like that. But the media that's in this film and the satire of it that's in this film between the talk show, but really the news report, is just the way it's done. The woman says, oh, it, you know, she was tossed like a salad and all of this stuff, and use all this real like hyperbole and sensationalistic wording and really kind of make fun of it.
This film, it's just every time I watch it, it actually gets funnier for me, which isn't necessarily the case with a lot of films. And I think that there's just so many little things that are going on with this. I mean, those kind of attention to detail that you're talking about, you know, you have to pay attention during this film to really catch everything. And I think it takes a while to even really start to crack the surface, which is so weird that I'm saying this about what should be, I mean, it's called Frankenhooker for f**k's sake. I mean, you know.
Exactly.
It shouldn't be something where, you know, it requires multiple viewings, but that's the beauty of it, is it does. And it's got so much stuff going on. And I think all of Henin Lotter's stuff really has this kind of multiple levels of action going on. And just really, he's a very well thought out filmmaker. He's got a lot of stuff happening, makes a lot of good choices, uses his oftentimes limited means to really make an impact. And he knows how to squeeze and dime and get a lot up on screen.
And all of these things, like when I've gone back and watched it again, like I think when I saw it on the first go, I'll admit I was a little tired, so I didn't get all the jokes. But one of the things that I appreciate now going back and looking at it, it's so funny, is the tone of it. Like the way the performances are, especially the guy who plays Jeffrey Franken. I love the speech that he gives about how he's trying to find bodies, and he's like, who should I get? And he's like, I'll just, you know, I'll create super crack. And he's like, they don't have to smoke it.
I mean, it's not like I'm committing murder. I'm not killing anybody. The crack is what's going to kill them. Hell, it's killing them already. I'm just speeding up the process, that's all. I'm not shooting anyone. I'm not stabbing anyone. I'm merely going to place a lethal form of crack in their presence. They don't have to take it.
And it's just the way he delivers that line is hilarious. I just was cracking up at that whole thing when I watched it again.
Just the pains that they go through to make sure that we stay sympathetic with Jeffrey through this film. So, yeah, that was nice that he had to remain sympathetic throughout the film. But it's funny because even if you go back to the original Frankenstein, you know, we're kind of pulling for Victor Frankenstein for, or, you know, in the American version, what was it, like Henry, whatever, Frankenstein, for so much of it. And then I don't know if there is a point or where the point is when we finally start to turn against him. At least I know personally I turn against Victor Frankenstein throughout the film. I guess it's once the creature shows that he has emotions and that he, you know, might have been born with a soul kind of thing. So, it, you know, but he really makes, Henin Lotter really makes great pains to make sure that we stay with Jeffrey through the film and that we don't turn against him throughout this, which I thought was very smart.
Comparing the two, I mean, when we talk about, obviously, the greatest American version, obviously, is the James Whale version with Boris Karloff. The Dr. Frankenstein character, I'm not sympathetic to him. I think he's kind of insane and kind of crazy. But with Frankenhooker, I don't really think he's that over the top. He's not as crazy for some reason. I think really in the original James Whale version, we are more sympathetic to the creature. I often used to see it as a corollary for all humanity, and that, you know, we kind of didn't ask to be born, and that us just being here at times is enough to provoke people to attack us. And the one thing that I find interesting about the Hennenlotter film Frankenhooker is that you have this character who not only wants to rebuild his girlfriend, future wife, it's that he, which is obviously a riff in a way to the brain that wouldn't die. And he's like, I can make you into anything. And he's like showing her all these photos with like her head pasted on top of like these models and stuff.
Honey pie, can't you picture yourself in this body kneeling on Ma's couch in the basement? How about the crawling cat, eh? How about this model? A visit to the sweet shop. I can make you into anything you want. I can make you the centerfold goddess of the century. Just need the right parts.
His girlfriend before, when she was a little heavy, I mean, she wasn't huge in the film, but she was a little heavy, it was not good enough that he's got to find a way to like make her like the perfect thing now. It's like, it's not enough just to bring her back.
Yeah, which is very funny to me, in that it's not just one woman, but it's that he has to get the best from all these different women. So yeah, it's like, what's the best butt, what's the best leg, you know, best arm, best foot, you know, it's just like all of these different parts, you know, and he's judging them all individually, which is pretty funny to me, where he's, you know, looking at each, he's breaking these women down, just completely objectifying them. It is definitely a commentary to me on, that kind of body consciousness and just how objectifying men can be. In my mind, when I was watching Frankenhooker the first time, I was thinking of it as being more like the original Frankenstein, where you've got, you know, the monster comes about fairly quickly, you know, I think what, like maybe end of the first act kind of thing, or a little bit after that. And I probably should have been thinking of it more in terms of like Bride of Frankenstein, where you really only get the bride right at the very end.
And that's one of the things also that I think the philosophy of Frankenstein, to me, to some extent, has always been sort of twofold. One is don't fool with nature. And the second one is, like I said, I could see it as a corollary for all of us. We didn't ask to be born, and the world can sometimes fight against us as the creature. Is I would go with Frankenhooker is that for someone who wants to engineer something to be perfect, keep in mind that certain things can get in the way of your perfection and therefore make it not as good as you think it's going to be. Because I'm sure that in the mind of this character, if we were going to talk to that character, as soon as he's about to lift the sheet off Patty Mullen, he was thinking, oh, great, you know, she'll be back to who she was. But the first words out of her mouth are,
want a date? Going out? Looking for some action? Need some company?
No, wait, huh? It's Jeffrey.
Got any money?
Money? No, I don't have any money.
And it just throws his entire world off as to what he thought he was creating. And I think it's brilliant that way.
It's funny, you know, talking about giving things life, you know, the way that this movie came about kind of had a life of its own. It was really just a riff of Hennenlotter's. He's in this producer's office trying to get this other project off the ground, this one called Insect City. And the story goes that he's, you know, pitching this to a producer. Producer's like, yeah, that sounds great. It'll never work. What else do you have? And Hennenlotter didn't have anything. And all of a sudden, he just starts riffing and comes up with Frankenhooker, you know, just as this stream of consciousness, so much so that he didn't even remember half the stuff that he said after he said it. So speaking of that, we should go ahead and take a little break, and we'll be back after a few words from our sponsors with an interview that I did with Frank Hennenlotter.
This is Mo. Nothing so odd about him, you may be thinking, except possibly the way he's looking at your barely legal cheerleader daughter. But he seems to have his life together. He has a job, a scooter, a house in the woods with a crawl space full of dolls' heads and empty beer cans. He's all American, rosy cheek, and proud of his heritage. But Mo, like so many others, is hiding a debilitating affliction. He is unable to stop himself from watching really bad movies. The disease has a long, cumbersome Latin name you couldn't hope to understand, but trust me, it's really serious. Left to his own devices, Mo can consume up to 15 truly horrendous motion pictures in under a day. His addiction reached its low point when his friend Bosch, who was just meant to be visiting for the evening, spent almost 3 days incapacitated under a metric ton of black clamshell VHS cases, surviving off nothing but old stale Buncher Crunch and Junior Mints. Mo barely noticed. There is hope, however, and you can help. For just no money at all, you can download an episode of the Drunk on VHS podcast on iTunes or go to drunkonvhs.blogspot.com and donate nothing whatsoever but your hard-earned time. $0 is all it costs to subscribe to all the episodes and possibly, who knows, save a child. A disease like this can never hope to be cured, but it can be controlled and carefully managed in small doses, or as scientists like to call them, podcasts. We here at the Second Unit Podcast Network are bringing together people like Mo and giving them a forum in which to safely cope with their addiction. You may think it's rare, but a VHS drunkard could be anywhere. That curious uncle you have who at family gatherings wants to show you his collection of nudie playing cards. The disheveled man in your office with the unsuitably long beard and a cubicle picture of Lorenzo Lamas. Hell, it could even be you. Donate by downloading the Drunk on VHS podcast today and support just one of the members of the Second Unit Podcast Network, fighting to make your internet a safe haven for freaks.
Ahoy, mateys. This is K.A.B., Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The smooth sound. 1340 KAB.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at adamandeve.com.
I want to know more about Insect City.
I never made it. It's not like you're missing anything, really. It's not a, you know, it's just, it's a weird script. It wasn't good. It's about somebody with a phobia for insects and does this radical therapy that goes wrong and actually gives birth to insects.
Oh, wow.
And it's a very strange thing. And I thought it was great because it was just insane. And to date the script, to date it, I actually had a MTV was just getting on. So I actually have a long sequence where these I was going to do a whole segment like a music video with these insects, you know, chewing their way through an apartment building and eating the people as on their way. They were large, you know. So it was a wild idea, but nobody seemed to get it. Nobody seemed to like it. You know, and Jim Glickenhaus, when I brought it to him, he appreciated the script for what it was. He didn't appreciate the fact that it wasn't going to be commercial. I mean, that's what his business is. He enjoyed the script, but he his words were something like, I liked it very much. I wouldn't sink a dime into it. It's no great loss, you know. It's like everything else. When you don't see something, you think it's better than it is. Who knows?
Was there any chance of it ever coming back?
No, I think it's dated. I've moved on. I mean, if you know, to me, I think ideas have a certain shelf life because you wrote them in the environment of what was out there at the time. And to go back, it's I think they date very fast. And I think I would have to completely reconceive the idea rather than remake that. You know, I got this website, thehotelbroslin.com, and I may post the script up there.
That would be neat to read.
I got to find it, though. You know, I mean, I don't know where it is, but I have tons of clutter, and you know, when I find, I finally found the original Basket Case script. We posted it on there. I started posting the brain damage script until my scanner died.
Oh, you know, geez.
So I got to get another scanner. But I, you know, when I get them, I'll post them. I think so that way people can read Insect City and go, yeah, whole lot of nothing. You know.
What? I can't believe that you made up Frankenhooker on the spot.
Well, I can't either, but I was so working overtime on it that I didn't remember what I said. I mean, I was just reacting to Jim laughing, and the more Jim laughed, the more I kept adding to the story. When we got done with the meeting, I went downstairs and I said to Edgar Ivins, who was the producer at the time with me, I said, what the hell did I just say? What's the plot? And he started telling me what the plot was, because I was out of my head as fast as it was, you know, as I said it. And he starts telling me this. I remember going, holy shit, I got to make this? So, okay, that worked out great, though.
Now, you worked on this and Basket Case 2 pretty much at the same time?
Yeah, because Jim also said, you know, we also discussed the idea of doing a sequel to Basket Case, which I resisted for many years because, after all, they died at the end of the first one. And also, I didn't know what to do with them. And I had another idea in my head about doing a film that was about a community of freaks. And I remember in the back of my head thinking, you know what would be funny is if late in the story I bring in Dwayne and Belial. So it wasn't really a sequel. It was like an extended cameo. So I kind of had it in the back of my head. And when Jim said, what else you got? Well, I had just used up every brain cell coming up with half the plot of Frankenhooker. I couldn't do it again. So I said to him, well, there's always Basket Case 2. And he said, oh, I like that too. He says, And he said, which one do you want to do? And I said, why don't we do them both? And he thought, and he said, yeah, that's a good idea. So most pre-production and Gabe Bartalo's effects was all done simultaneously. For instance, Jeffrey's lab in Frankenhooker was the attic set in Basket Case 2, because we built them both knowing the same structure can serve as both, you know, with different, obviously with different walls and props, but they both needed to be elevated in order for the puppeteers to be beneath the floor making things move. And when Gabe Bartalos was doing the effects, half a shop was working on the Basket Case 2 freaks while we were filming Frankenhooker, because that needed more work. You know, that had a lot more elaborate effects than Frankenhooker did. And in fact, when I went to, when I filmed a scene in Frankenhooker in Times Square, I also filmed the scene of the reporter for Basket Case 2. We filmed Frankenhooker for 6 weeks, and then we wrapped and we turned things around, and then we started Basket Case 2.
And then Basket Case 2 ended up coming out, what, like a month earlier?
Yeah, because we needed to do the post-production optical effects for Frankenhooker, which, you know, in those days was not CGI, so they took a longer time to do.
Was it just more practical effects for Basket Case 2?
Oh, yeah, there were no optical effects in that. It was all just, it's just tons of monsters in that one. It's just great. It's like tons and tons of monsters. We have so many freaks in every scene. It's just, it's fantastic. It's really beautifully f***ed up eye candy. You know, it's just like, whoa, you know.
That was pretty neat doing two back-to-back, doing that as a money-saving idea for, I would say, lower-budget films. It was pretty revolutionary.
Yeah, I'm not sure they saved a lot of money. I'm not sure, but what it saved was a lot of time in that when we found the location to set up our studio, so to speak, we didn't need a move. We just cranked out two movies. In fact, when we finished Frankenhooker, everyone was so beat up that the whole idea that we had to do another one right away really was not. Everybody was kind of moaning, like, oh my God, we got to go on. By the time we finished Basket Case 2, everybody regretted that we didn't have a third one to do. Everyone was having such a good time. We felt like a machine now, you know. So, yeah, I wish we did have a third one. And I wish it hadn't been Basket Case 3.
Yeah, I was wondering if you were pretty frazzled at the end, you know, having done two films.
No, I could have done another one if we had it ready. I just couldn't have written one fast enough.
So when it came to the casting of Frankenhooker, how did you get some of the folks for this? I mean, because Jeffrey, amazing.
James Lorenz, I saw him in Street Trash. And I thought, and I had seen a bunch of dailies from Street Trash. I saw, before the film was actually finished or even edited, I had seen a bunch of dailies from it. And I saw most of Lorenz's material straight out of the camera. In fact, I thought he was the star of Street Trash. And I said to Jimmy Murrell, you got nothing to worry about. You got a great leading man. And he said to me, oh, you know, he's only in one scene. And I said, oh, that's a mistake. Write more for him. But, you know, it was too late. He already had a script. You know what I mean? I thought Lorenz was just, you know, so damn funny. And I mean, I couldn't take my eyes off him when he was on camera. He was just great. So he was in the back of my head. While I was writing Frankenhooker, I hadn't thought of him. It was when I wrote the scene where Jeffrey puts the drill in his head. And then I thought, you know what? I can't just have a normal actor play this. I have to have a comic actor. I have to have somebody with a really great sense of comic timing who can play it straight but has that comic edge. And immediately I thought of Lorenz. And he was a great choice. I mean, just great.
On the DVD, there's an interview with one of the women that plays a prostitute.
Yeah. Oh, Jennifer DeLora.
Thank you. Yeah. Listening to her interview, she seemed to be not a big fan of Lorenz's methods.
I didn't know that. I had nothing to do with that. I may direct the film. I'm not the guy who puts together the extras on, you know, DVDs. And I would have edited that out. I don't think that belongs on a disc. I know it's her opinion. She's absolutely entitled to it. And if she felt that way, so be it. I don't know what the particulars are. You know, I was too busy to see who got along with whom. I just was, you know, I have blinders on when I'm making a film, so I have no idea if they even met on the set. You know what I mean? Of course they did, but I mean, I had no idea. Nevertheless, I'm sure that was her sincere opinion. That was the first time I learned of her opinion, was when I played the disc. And immediately I moaned. I thought, oh, man, this should have been cut.
Well, yeah, you had your hands full, because not only were you directing, but you were shooting a lot of stuff, too.
Yeah, honestly, you don't... I'm very unaware of the interaction of a lot of the stuff that's going on because I am so, just the way they're unaware of what I have to go through. You know, it's madness. That's what it is. It's madness. It's like everything is hyper and everything is different and it's not the real life world. It could very well be that she misinterpreted something because James was very intense and very focused and he's pretty much stayed in character on the set. So who knows?
I couldn't take my eyes off of him either. He just seemed so out there.
Yeah.
And just so, he was so fun to watch.
Yeah. No, he is. I mean, look at how many times I just relied on him. I just let the camera hold on him. He was so damn inventive. And a lot of what he was saying was ad-libs, but they were planned ad-libs in the sense of he ran them by me first in the rehearsal process. And I would say 95% of them make me laugh. And I said, go with it. And if I didn't, I don't know why not. It probably wasn't because it was funny. It wasn't funny. It was probably because of some other reason. It was a great way of working because it looks like a completely spontaneous performance. It looks like he's making it up on the spot, and that's the way it should be.
Is his accent, was that natural or did...
Yeah, no, he does talk like that. Yeah, he does.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was always curious.
Yeah, no, it's funny as hell. Yeah.
It's great, you know, him being, you know, constantly crossing over into Manhattan from Jersey and everything. And
yeah,
it's
okay.
That's nice. How was it with Patty Mullen?
Oh, fabulous. She was, I mean, you know, I thought I had the two best leads because I didn't want a predictable Frankenhooker. I wouldn't have gone with a sex pot. I wouldn't have gone with a scream queen. I wouldn't have gone with, you know, somebody that... I didn't think Patty looked the part, despite the fact that she was a penthouse pet of the year. When she walked in my office, she didn't look like a penthouse pet. She looked like a girl next door. And she was so down to earth and so innocent and giggling and charming that I thought, oh my God, it would be perfect. And then I was thrilled to learn that she was a penthouse pet. So I knew, okay, I won't have problems with the nudity or anything like that. And this was only her second film. And she was a bit nervous, and all I said to her was, just make me laugh. If you see me laughing, you know you're doing a good job. I may have shown her a clip of Karloff, but I was saying to her, you got to get this walk down and on these big Frankenstein shoes so you don't, you know, you look like you're constantly off balance, which she did very quickly. And then I don't remember where the face contortions came from. I think my recollection is she just did that one day, and I went nuts laughing. So we decided, okay, that's it. You know, you're still having trouble with the face and keeping it together. And I mean, she makes me laugh now. Every time I watch the film, that's the beauty of the movie. I can still laugh at Lorenz and I can still laugh at Patty.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that it was only her second film because she does have great comic timing.
She really does, and she has great screen presence. You can't take your eyes off her either. In fact, I regret now that there wasn't a bigger part for her, but really the part, you know, it was kind of, you know, it was a one-joke idea, kind of, let's not push it, you know? You know, so, okay.
Yeah, I've always been curious, like, with her head in that tank, if you had ever thought of, you know, because you had mentioned on the commentary about being inspired by the brain that wouldn't die. Did you ever think about having her head be alive?
No, I don't mind being inspired by a film, but I don't want to rip it off or do it. You know what I mean? In fact, I showed the film one night to Joe Green, who's the director of The Brain That Wouldn't Die, about maybe a year or two before he passed. He had the impression that I had done a remake of it. And when he started watching it, he was howling and he said, "Oh, Frank, I'm so glad this isn't a remake of it." He loved it. He just loved it. And then when he got done, he goes, "Well, that's not fair. You had more money than I did."
Well, I like that there's touches of Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein, but not enough. I mean, there aren't any, to me, any direct lifts.
It's just touchstones. It's just playing, taking a bunch of icons and putting it in our pocket and then just, you know, spitting them out when we need them. That's about it.
And it's a gorgeous film. It is so nice to look at, so colorful.
Yeah, well, that was the point. I wanted a comic book. You know, I wasn't making a horror film. I never sort of, I still don't see it, think it's a horror movie. I think it's a comedy, period, which is why there's no, I didn't put any blood in it. I just didn't think that belonged in the film. Well, the problem I always had with when we were writing the script, that I wrote it with Bob Martin, the first editor of Fangoria. The problem we had was, well, okay, Jeffrey has to get these parts. Jeffrey has to make a monster out of these parts. The problem we had was, well, how does he get the parts? Does he actually kill these women? Because the moment Jeffrey kills them, you're going to hate his guts. And the comedy is over, and the film comes to a halt. So we were wrestling as to what would it be. And in the back of our head, we always decided that probably the killings of the hooker should be accidental, even though Jeffrey plans it. And it was one day when I was walking down the street at Manhattan here where it was right at the epidemic of crack, which when it was new, it was all over the place. And there was this street that had crack vials. So many crack vials that you're walking, it was like walking on rock salt. They were just crunching under your feet. And I remember walking with it under my feet and thinking, oh, wait a minute. Yes, yes, a new kind of crack, super crack. Oh, we've got it. We've got it, you know. And then it was great because we have Jeffrey make the super crack, set it up, and very importantly, decide not to go through with it. And because, you know, in super crack, of course, the girls, in a sense, kill themselves. So we very nicely navigate. We got our exploding hookers and we don't hate Jeffrey. Yay, we win.
And those exploding hookers look so good.
Yeah, that's my favorite scene. That's the only, you know, I don't sit and watch my own movies. They're very painful because I want to change things. But every so often, I like watching the hookers explode, that sequence. That scene still makes me laugh. And it's just beautiful. And I don't care if it looks real or not. We didn't want it to look real. We wanted it to look like a fireworks. You know, that's why you listen to the sound effects. The sound effects are all fireworks going off, you know? And I thought it worked well. It's funny as hell. And you put an awful lot of work in. We predetermined the poses the girls would die in. And, you know, hell it was to make body casts of them. Well, it wasn't for the technicians. They have naked girls in there. But, you know, but it was a lot of work to get these to do body casts of different parts of them and then put it all together and to build them and to bring them on the set. Then to have the real girl stop in that pose, stop, move the statues in. We traced their draw. We traced an outline for them on the TV monitor that we were doing. And then blew them up. So all that work for a split second. And, you know, once you blow it up, that's it, folks. There was no second mannequin. You know, so we had to hold our breath every time and hope, well, I hope it blows up well. And I love the one with Leah Chang, whose head just goes flying off perfectly. Oh, my God. I thought that, you know. So, yeah, it was a lot of work for, you know, for basically a bad joke.
We've had nothing but remakes and reboots for the last few years. Any remakes or reboots of Frankenhooker or the Basket Case films coming up?
Nope, not that I know of.
Oh, thank God.
I've had, I did have, spent a year with somebody who wanted to, wanted to do a remake of Basket Case, and he had great ideas, and I think it would have been a pretty interesting project with him involved. But they basically wanted to hand me $12 and me to give them everything, and that was not how it was going to work. they were just going to take everything and, you know, okay, wait a minute, you know, I should be a partner on any future. No, thanks. Okay, all right, we'll up the offer to $20. How's that? I don't know what the thinking was. I don't know if the thinking was that because I'm not in Hollywood and haven't made that many movies, maybe I'm so desperate for money I will do anything. But, you know, why don't you find out that's true first before you do some stupid deal like this? So, you know, and that was that. I don't regret it because I really didn't want a Basket Case remake made.
Can I ask you a little bit about the doc you're working on now?
It's going to be called That's Exploitation. And it's a visual history of 4 decades of non-Hollywood sex. We're talking exploitation film sex scenes from theatrical releases, shorts, loops, even stags. Nothing hardcore, though. You know, the guiding force is David F. Friedman, who is going to take us on the journey. And we filmed this right before his death. He was waiting to do this film for quite a while, and we got it done just in time, fortunately. And I only regret that he's not going to be able to see it. But it's funny as hell, and that was the emphasis we were putting it on. We just went for the wackiest, nuttiest, craziest, most idiotic clips we could find. a naked girl is one thing. Fine. We applaud. We love it. Okay. But a naked girl standing in a living room wearing a snorkel mask and flippers. Now that's something else, you know? Or a rather plump, borderline heavy, completely naked girl lying in bed, covered head to toe with plastic cowboys and Indians. Yeah.
And you know you're hitting somebody's fetish with that.
You really think there's one person on the planet that has a fetish? I really don't. I really don't. I don't think that's anyone's. I look at that snorkel mask and think, this can't be real. Nobody could find this sexy. So that's kind of that's two of the clips we've got in this, to give you an idea. That's what we're going for.
Are you making this one in conjunction with Something Weird Video?
Oh, absolutely. It's our follow-up to the Herschel Gordon Lewis documentary.
Which was terrific. That was so good.
Well, this is going to be, I think this is not only going to be, it's better because this is crazier. We're not, all we are limited to is basically a timeline of what happened when. And Dave Friedman is our one talking head. We don't need anybody else. We didn't round up anybody else, you know? God knows, I mean, who's left anyway? You know what I'm saying? There's not too many people left, and the last thing I want to do is find some actress who is now a grandma. You know, I mean, I didn't think that would look good, you know? So anyway, you know, it's going to be a fun doc.
Where can folks go to keep up on the progress with it?
Nowhere yet, because it's not finished. I'm still working on it. In fact, before you called, I was sitting there and doing a piece about Stacey Walker. And as soon as I hang up from you, I'm going to continue with Dave talking about Stacey Walker. And I think I'll be done with it in about a month or two. And then from there, I don't know. I'll probably, you know, we'll put something on a Facebook page and let the world know. Such a pleasure to do it, because, I mean, I just find myself laughing every day. You know, looking at this stuff and shaking my head going, good Lord, what were they thinking? You know, it's basically 1929 to 1969. We ended at the birth of hardcore porn. It's not sexploitation then, it's pornography. So, you know, it'll be, I think a lot of people are going to expect that it may be, you know, like as soon as you hear it, you think, oh yeah, this is jerk-off material. Oh no. This is so far past that. This is outer space. You know, this is movies that were made on, you know, Venus and Mars. I mean, it's hard to believe these were made on our planet.
Welcome back to the Projection Booth. So, you know, we talked a little bit about the way that this thing is structured. I'm very curious about what you thought about the ending to this one, Rob. So I don't want us to spoil anything because there is kind of a twist at the end. So if we can not do that, okay. But I mean, this film is quite a few years old. So if we do spoil it for anybody, I apologize. But you should still go out and see this thing. It's definitely worth it. And like I said, it gets richer with each viewing experience. So with that caveat, major caveat, go ahead, Rob. What did you think about the ending of this?
Well, I'm going to tap dance into no man's land here and see if I can not hit a landmine. Well, there's a couple of things, you know, with the ending. I mean, to me, I sort of saw it as a way of the character of Elizabeth and now the Frankenhooker as a way of getting other people to understand how it feels to live in a body that doesn't quite work for you. That's what I kind of saw it as. I saw it as almost sort of a light revenge. I also saw it as we were talking before, sort of this parable on the creator that basically you can create something and it may be great, but there's really no way of knowing how it may end up backfiring on you. And I think that's sort of the tale in the original James Whale Frankenstein. I also think the ending kind of asks some questions about fundamentally what happens when masculinity is changed, or what someone believes is the perception of masculinity. He has this whole thing where he's talking about, I have this blood serum that's estrogen-laden blood serum, so therefore I can, you know, make women, but I can't do anything for men. And in the end, it's sort of a question of, is it better to be dead than to basically be emasculated in some way? And I hope that doesn't give away the total ending for people. That was something that I also thought was in there. I don't necessarily know that if this was something that was sort of thought up and then written, or these are just things that I'm reading into it. I sort of felt similar way with Bloodsucking Freaks, in that I think Joel Reed had some ideas, but I don't think he had an idea of what all of these various things meant in terms of a symbolic level when looking at sort of dynamics of men and women, power structure, and things like that.
It definitely comes back to bite him that he doesn't really think about, you know, creating anything more than just his one creature. So, yeah, there is a definite poetic justice to that. Going back to what you said before the break, you know, you talked about that the James Whale version of Frankenstein is pretty much, you know, the definitive version. I would definitely argue that Kenneth Branagh was onto something.
He was on something. I don't know if he was onto something.
Sorry.
But I have to give him one thing, Kenneth Branagh. Okay, first off, John Cleese is in the film. He does okay. And number two is, instead of it being electricity, it's electric eels. So yeah. I'm like, that's pretty sweet. He's got like this tub full of electric eels that he hooks up a cut up version of Robert De Niro to. So that's kind of fun.
Well, you know, electric eels are a little bit more reliable than waiting on a big storm and stuff. So, yeah, but yeah, God, that was. Sorry. I can never say enough bad things about that film. So I just had to bring Kenneth in the room and give him one for that.
But it belongs to that whole tale of film. Like I honestly believe this is true. There are very few movies out there where the author's name and then the title of the film is any good. Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, Bram Stoker's Dracula. Whenever they do a movie and they put the author's name first and then the title of the film or the book, watch out.
I seem to remember that they were being legally obligated to do that for some reason, and I don't know why. I don't know why they would have to do that. I mean, there have been so many versions of Frankenstein and Dracula without the names above the title, and I was like, what? Why? Why all of a sudden? And it might have been that at one point, I think Francis Ford Coppola might have said Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula as opposed to, you know, Bram Stoker's, and I think the Stoker estate might have got on his case about that.
But really, what they should have done is let him put his name above that film, so therefore we know who to send the hate mail to.
Exactly. Oh my God. So anyway, getting back to Frankenhooker, which is much better than Kenneth Branagh's Frankenstein. You know, Helen Lauder really has a lot of, I don't want to say body issues, but his films deal with a lot of questions about body and, you know, flesh and this whole kind of he's got a fascination with the way that bodies work, which I find him to be kind of like the, almost like the American Cronenberg in that way. You know, Cronenberg has such body issues, and unfortunately, he's kind of gotten away from that a little bit with some of his films more recently.
I see that, but the one thing is that you have to understand is I think they come from two completely different backgrounds. I mean, I would say that Cronenberg is more of a classical filmmaker who is dealing with horror of the flesh ideas that come from probably more from literature or maybe even from painting. I would say maybe things like Francis Bacon or something like that. While Hennenlotter, as we all know, comes from exploitation. I mean, he is a guy who is informed by the work that Dave Freeman did. And whether that be, you know, the sex films, the exploitation sex films that Dave Friedman did, or whether it be the stuff that he did with Herschel Gordon Lewis that was horror film, you know, to some extent. I mean, I think that you're getting Cronenberg from the highbrow school and you're getting Hennenlotter from the lowbrow school. And I think they kind of talk to a lot of similar issues, but they're talking at it from a slightly different angle.
Well, it's funny that you had brought up Bloodsucking Freaks before, because I was reminded a little bit of Bloodsucking Freaks while we were watching this, just because of the Jeffrey character's journeys into Manhattan. And when you see him coming in, you know, you're just seeing that really kind of sleazy Manhattan that we had talked about. You know, this is pre-cleanup. This is when you still see, you know, these are actual hookers that he's shooting on some of these, you know, drive-bys that he has. And I was reminded of our discussion of Bloodsucking Freaks and just that kind of sleazy area, the sleazeball attitude that was happening in New York, which is funny. I mean, God, that was mid-70s that Bloodsucking Freaks was, and this is, you know, almost 15 years later, and it's still pretty rank, But I definitely agree that there is a lot to unpack in that last scene. And it's kind of funny because I think that the ending was almost an afterthought. One of these, like, how do we end this thing? We've got a lot of women's body parts around here. Why don't we do something with them kind of thing? But it definitely opens up a whole new discussion. It makes you look at the film in a whole different way, really, as you go through it. So it's almost like I would like there to be almost another, you know, 10 minutes worth of the film where they kind of investigate what's going to happen. But obviously, you know, the way that it ends is the perfect kind of shocker twist ending, you know, that should be there. But yeah, it has a lot of nice meanings that are going on with it that just make this film an even more rich experience.
When you listen to the commentary and you listen to obviously the interview you just did with Frank Hennenlotter, is that you get the idea that he is trying to satirize the state of New York at that time to some extent with hookers run amok, with the crack epidemic, all that stuff. And I think that, I mean, this is a rather short film. It's only like, you know, it's almost an hour and a half. It might be a few minutes shy of that. Is I think if he would have took like five more minutes in that section where Jeffrey kind of comes up with the idea to create the super crack and give it to the hookers and all that stuff, just a little bit more, he could have had such a scalpel, you know, pull on that whole kind of dregs of society thing, and not make it much like how he made the rest of the film, where he's not attacking the individual much so much as he's attacking the idea that these things have run amok, and it's like, what are we doing as a society?
I think that there could have been a little bit more biting commentary, a little bit more satire to this. Like I said before, like that whole, this is Jeffrey's thing and the world just kind of accepts it. It would almost be interesting if everybody accepted it, because he does kind of, you know, he's a little bit on the fringes of the law by, you know, blowing up hookers and all this kind of stuff. But it would have been interesting if there were people that just accepted that the way that Jeffrey's family accepts that he's there with a brain with an eyeball in the middle of it on their dining room table. I think that would have been kind of a neat element to have, but whatever. I mean, woulda, shoulda, coulda.
The other thing I thought about in the end with the ending, to me, it's just the idea also in the Frankenstein story is narcissistic, at least in this version of it, where it's someone trying to create something that reflects back to them a certain ideal that they have in their own mind of what somebody should be or what society should be or how people should be in some way. And that's a very narcissistic idea.
All right, we're going to go ahead and we'll take a break and play a preview from next week's show.
No, she scares me, Raymond. There's something I don't know. She's... You don't know, you can't even imagine, but she's my baby, my little girl, and she came out of me. It's not her fault.
You've been feeling strange lately, Barbara. Confused. This confusion has been transmitted to you from another time, another place, beyond human knowledge and understanding. They're forces, inhuman ones, out of this world, and they're unspeakably evil.
What are you begging me for?
Well, I just...
Oh my God, what is that?
Go fuck yourself.
You used your powers to make it go faster.
No, I didn't.
Don't you talk to me like that! How dare you talk to me or anybody else like that!
A trailer from next week's show all about The Visitor. We'll be joined by Josh Hadley from the Lost in the Static podcast, who turned me on to this strange little flick. This is the 52nd official episode of The Projection Booth. It'd be more if I counted all those special episodes on things like Captain America, Fright Night, Manos, the Hands of Fate, etc. But in most places, 52 weeks makes a year, so congratulations to anyone out there who's made it through the first year of The Projection Booth podcast, and here's to many more to come. There's a great slate of upcoming flicks on the horizon, but I'd also like to throw open the suggestion box to listeners to hear what films y'all would like us to cover. I'd also be interested in some feedback on the shows we've done. Give us a call or leave us a voicemail on the hotline, which is 734-666-0800, and it would be great to hear from you.
At 734-666-0800, of course you had to pick 666, Mike.
Of course.
And like Mike said, stick around. Of course, there's always more to come, and you can leave feedback for us on iTunes or via the website at projection-booth.com. And of course, we always answer your questions and comments as soon as they come in, and also helps to continue the conversation beyond the show that you hear here each and every week.
Boy, that sounded very much like the fundraiser talk kind of thing, you know. Once again, that number is 734-666-0800. It's people like you that make the Projection Booth possible.
Order now, and you'll get the free tote bag with the brain inside the tote bag.
No tote bags.
That's right. 734-666-0800 on this Projection Booth fundraiser.
We've only got a few minutes left,
and only a few left of the Frankenhooker doll. That's right. It's an 8-inch doll made of plastic and removable parts. You can take it apart. You can put it all together. You can put her leg where her arm is and her arm where her leg is. You can put her head where her leg is. You can do whatever you want with this thing, but you got to order now. That's right. You got to get in now and support this fine podcast that you listen to each and every week. That's 734-666-0800.
Let's go ahead. We're going to squeeze the stomach on this Frankenhooker doll here and listen to what she says.
Want a date?
That's right, folks. Want a date? You want a date with the projection booth? Give us a call, 734-666-0800. We need your support right now. We're coming right down to the end of this hour. We need to hear from you.
There are many podcasts in the world that you could be listening to at this moment, but you're listening to us. And therefore, that says to me that you're invested and you care about the projection booth. So how can you make sure that you get quality film podcasts each and every week? It's simple. 734-666-0800 is the number to call, or you can go to projection-booth.com and make your gift and donation right there online. It's simple, easy, and we can bring another year of the projection booth to you each and every week. Right here at the projection booth. Thank you.
Got any money?
Wonderful. That's the end of the show right there.
I want to apologize to everybody here, please. I'm going to put everybody back together. I promise you.